Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's
Each week, they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff, too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
That's a wrap. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Liam, for dropping in.
Okay, good pleasure. To have you. I'm having one of Stevie's pints, so it's all good.
We're kidding, folks. We got a great show coming up for you today. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim.
Better
Jerome,
be a great show.
Come, just would you pipe down, okay? Is there nothing that doesn't piss you off, okay? That, of course, is the voice of Rusty Cortinel, the one and only long-time NHLer without ever winning a cup.
Fuck off.
There it is. The White Claws, the opening of the show. This is a great show. I've been looking forward to this for two rounds of the playoffs now, to be honest with you. Rusty, you played in Montreal. We've done lots of talking about Montreal over the last two rounds. Of course, unless you've been living in a cave, Montreal has been pulling off what nobody thought they could. By winning the first round, you know, against the Leafs. Of course, the Leafs are, I don't know, they might have been the most favored team in the playoffs, right up there with the Colorados and Tampa and everybody else. So then they go on to crush Winnipeg in the second round, and here they are in the third round. So it's a day. It's really a day. We record this. We should have waited till tomorrow, I guess, because the game's tonight. We're recording before the first game of the Montreal Vegas series. Rusty, you loved your days in Montreal. You talk about them fondly. You talk about the fans being the greatest fans ever. And then you and I don't break down hockey games. There's two reasons we don't. You don't like doing it, and I don't know enough to break down a hockey game. But you were telling me, Rusty, before we bring on our guest, you were telling me watching Vegas, Colorado. And you've watched a bunch of hockey. You know, your whole life has been around. You said this is some of the best hockey you've ever seen, Russ?
I think it's some of the best games in the playoffs. Yeah, the games are phenomenal in every series. And in the past, we've had really good hockey in the playoffs. But every series, and I haven't seen every game, but the games I've watched have just been phenomenal. And I think it's been great for the fans watching their teams play each other because they've been so exciting. And now we've got some upsets and I think it's just delivering such great entertainment for all hockey fans. Obviously the Leaf fans are pissed off and upset, but for an overall hockey fan, it's just been, they've delivered and the NHL should be very proud of what they've got going right now.
Yeah. When you look back, Rusty, what playoff round in your life sort of reminds you of what you're seeing now that you look at it and go, that reminds you of the 2 weeks that we played so and so, or what jumps out in your own career?
I mean, I don't know. I played a lot of games. I think I played 129 games or something like that. Had some upsets both for and against. Detroit upset us when we were up three games to zero, and they beat us in seven. That sucked. So I know how some teams are feeling right now. And then when we were young, we upset Chicago Blackhawks when I played for the Leafs. That was when the series were first series were best of five, and we swept Chicago. And we had the least amount of points to make the playoffs, maybe in NHL history. And we beat, they were, I think, the second to Edmonton that year in points. And we kicked their ass. And so I've been on both sides of it.
Right.
You will, if you play long enough, you'll be on both sides.
Right.
So I've, you know, over 16 years had those two experiences that stand out. A lot of game sevens, that I played in. Anyways, experienced it all, but like you said, you fucking asshole, I didn't win the cup.
You know, I have heard over my whole life, you know, I grew up watching hockey with my dad. He was a huge Habs fan. He'd be turning in his grave right now going, okay, just let me out. God, let me out for one series here. Okay. Can I just get out? Okay. He would be loving this. So I grew up a Habs fan. Rusty, you've talked about your days, as we said earlier, in Montreal and Toronto, of course. You played for, you know, two of the most iconic hockey teams in the mm-hmm. NHL. And I've heard stories of people who say, oh yeah, you think you're a fan? Okay, I'm a fan, right? I've got a shrine in my basement. I painted my freaking car red, blue, and white. Okay, I got maple leaves all over my, I got a tattoo. I named my dog Rocket. I named my kid Guy. I did all this stuff, you know, for Montreal. But none of that. That all pales in comparison to the guest we're about to bring on is a longtime friend of mine. We went to high school together. We sort of went different routes. Liam went on after high school to spend a few years in college, and I spent those 3 years in grade 13 again. So that was how I did it. Liam, for our Ottawa listeners, we've got listeners from around the world, but our Ottawa ones will certainly know Liam, and so will anybody else in Canada. Liam has devoted his life to hockey. And don't take this wrong, Liam, before I bring you on, but what started out as a party trick, okay, with his knowledge of and his love for the Montreal Canadiens has turned into a living and a passion for Liam. He is the number one guy in the world on the planet for hockey history and trivia, but we've all known that. And when you hear what he's done and devoted his life to the Montreal Canadiens, all that shit I just told you about, yeah, you think you're a fan. I said, I got to bring Liam on. This is a big day for him. And Liam, how are you, brother? You're joining us for the first time on the Suspendables.
I am, Jimmy. Great to be here.
Attaboy, Liam.
Great to be with you guys. Russ, great to chat with you. I watched you play live a number of times, so it was a real honor to be on with both you guys. No, the show's great. I've listened to many of them. And Jimmy, like you say, we go way back. Your brother Paul was 1 year behind me at Pius. You were two. And I believe Joe was right after you, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, your late brother Joe. And, you know, we all know who your family was because of your dad, you know, Speaker of the House. And you guys cut your own swath at that school, that's for sure. And it's, you know, Glenn Gretzky reconnected us in 1999. You may recall, Jimmy, before you started at what was then OSR 1200, Glenn Gretzky introduced, Wayne's youngest brother introduced us at the Prescott Hotel when I was on tour across Canada for Labatt's. And next thing you know, you were on, I think within a year doing the radio gig and the rest is history in that sense.
Right.
But we've always stayed in touch. You got me down at Gretzky's fantasy camp in Arizona that time when Gordie Howe was a special guest. I will always, always treasure that night. That me being on, I don't know if you remember or not, Jimmy, they put me on the front end loader there on the riser.
I do.
In the warehouse, put me up above the crowd. And I had one of the greatest experiences of my life because I told the story of the only time that Wayne Gretzky didn't start a game with his sweater tucked in, which was a habit started by Walter in Wayne's first year of hockey when he was 6 years old, playing against 11 years old. The sweater was too big, tucked it in. Only game that it didn't happen. First game against the Russians, 1979, WH All-Stars, again, 3-game set against the Russian national team. And Gordie Howe pulls Wayne's jersey out and said, let me fix that for you, kid, and took a roll of hockey tape and taped it around the bottom of Wayne's pants, and he didn't know what to do. He was mortified because Howe was his idol. So they went on the ice. 30 seconds into the game, Mark Howe scores with passes from Gordie and Wayne. They went on to win the game and win the series. And I'm in front of the crowd, Jimmy, including you, as you know, and I said, we can now finally find out if this story is true, because the two main guys are here. Gordie Howe way over to my left and Wayne Gretzky to my right. And I looked over to Wayne and he looked over at Gordie and Gordie just said, that's 100% true. And the place went nuts. Place went absolutely nuts.
They did.
Amazing.
So I told you, Rusty, when I talked to you, it's going to be very difficult to get Liam to give us his thoughts on things. Really tough to get him to speak up.
Yeah.
So what you heard there, you know, when you heard Liam said, I was on tour with Labatt's, Jimmy, you brought me down to the fantasy camp to show my act. So Liam is like I said, you're going to be blown away here by what he's going to talk about and what he knows. We're doing this live, so there's no heads up for Liam on this. But Liam, let's first start. Talk about how good of a fan you are. Give us some shit that you've done as a Montreal Canadiens fan.
Well, you said in the preamble there where I guess maybe I fit in. I mean, the every single fan base of every sport has their fanatics, right? The word fan is short for fanatics, and I'm no different. I was that kid growing up. I slept in the Montreal Canadiens sweater. I always wanted to be number 12 because my favorite player was Yvan Cournoyer. My first trip to the Montreal Forum, Saturday night, May 1st, 1975, Game 3 semifinals against the Buffalo Sabres. Habs won 7-0, Guy Lafleur's first playoff hat trick. That night is revered in my memory as almost a religious experience. I was at the Forum 344 times in 21 years, including 78 playoff games. And I used to leave that building and run my hand against the walls and just think of what it must have been like when the Rocket played in here and Howie Morenz played in here. And I used to look for a little spot maybe where I could hide on security so I could be there for practice the next day. And it was the building and the team and the city. I was born in Montreal. My mom's French Canadian. She's from Quebec City. So, you know, I moved up here to the Ottawa area, the rurals as it's called, when I was 7 years old. I mean, I call this home for sure, but I'm Montreal born, and they were the only NHL team, closest one by far, as you know, Jimmy, right, in those days. And in 1971, the summer I turned 12, that was the summer Guy Lafleur got drafted. The Montreal Canadiens drafted a defenseman named Larry Robinson. And he's from a town called Marvelville. And the arena in Metcalf is named after him now, the Larry Robinson Arena. But he was from a smaller town even than Metcalf called Marvelville. And I was 12 years old, and Larry was a hell of a ball player. And he used to play for a team called the Turpin Pontiacs. They were a legendary fastball team in Ottawa in the early 70s. And Larry was a member of that team with a bunch of guys who later became good friends of mine. And they came to play the Cars Aces. I grew up outside a small town called Cars, Ontario, on the Cars Road, and we went there, and that was the biggest man I had ever seen in my life at that time. He was an absolute giant, and he had been drafted by the Montreal Canadiens. Like, these things just all cemented this love affair for me with that crest and that sweater and that city and that team. And then when I started going to the games and then started doing the hockey trivia, that building, like I said, Russ, I saw you score in overtime in 92 against Hartford. I saw your OT goal against Buffalo. I was in the building those games. Both those games I was there. And like I said, 344 times. And when it came time for me to propose to my girlfriend, the only place I could think of doing it was at center ice of the Montreal Forum. And it took a couple weeks to set up. I'm not going to lie. It took actually the help of a lot of people. Dick Irvin, John Shipman was one of the trainers there at the time.
Shipper.
Donald Beauchamp had just started on the job, and he likes to tell – he's retired now, but he likes to tell the story that he was so wet behind the ears that he didn't have enough gumption to say no to me. So he said, yeah, go ahead. And on a Friday night, September 10th, 1993, at 7:35 p.m., Liz and I walked in out of a limo into the Montreal Forum with the building completely empty, but every single light on. For me. And I went into center ice and got down on one knee, and I got pictures of it. And I said, Liz, I got a trivia question for you, and the answer is yes, okay? And I popped the question, and I'm the only man in the 71-year, 3-month, 17-day history of that building for NHL hockey to propose at center ice. That's how much that building and that team means to me. So wow. Am I the greatest fan ever? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, there's nobody bigger. There's others that are probably every bit as fanatical. But I am the Habs, man. And the Habs are me. They are my life.
Yeah, listen, Liam, I know you are, because what people don't know, that they're going to find out today, Liam, about you, that they've never heard before, okay? But I know this. I've seen you sit around the bar, and then everyone's like, this guy's a freaking freak, man, the shit he knows. and then Rusty, okay? Because Liam doesn't mind to have the odd pop, you know? Yeah. Are you still export ale guy,
Liam? Olsen X, drink it hard, drink it fast, drink it by the gallon. 105,000 pints in, give or take 400 or 500.
Okay. So I've seen a guy try and straighten him out, Liam, Rusty. Yeah. Okay, he's got a bit of an edge to him, by the way. Liam still hits the heavy bag and stuff like that, okay? For a guy who's up, 82 years old, all right? He still does this. So I saw a guy get a little testy with him, right? Mm-hmm. Going, you're making that shit up, right? Liam, okay, right away. Really, pal? Really? Do you want to fucking go? Okay, here we go. Here we go. So, Liam, you've made your life out of hockey, and I know you, you know, as well as anyone else does about what you do, and these numbers that we just heard people rattle off. It's not something you have written down. It's something that comes out of the top of your head. Let's first talk about Liam, how that all started for you. So let's give everyone an example of what you can do. For example, I'll throw a year at you.
Yep. I'll tell you who won the Stanley Cup. We'll go from there. Give me any year. Going back to 1893, any year.
1925.
1925 was the Victoria Cougars.
Yeah, baby, yeah. My hometown.
Your hometown, Russ. There you go. Yeah, Victoria Cougars. In fact, they who beat owned the Canadians. I don't know who owned the Cougars in 25.
Fuck, who knows that, Russ? Come on, give me a break.
Is there a story there, Russ? Do you know that?
They moved the team to Detroit.
They moved to Detroit. They became the Detroit Cougars, then the Detroit Falcons, and then the Detroit Red Wings. That was their third team name in Detroit. Patricks owned the team and the league, I believe, at that time.
You're right.
Good one.
Yeah, Victoria one. Cougars. They had Barney Stanley, I think, was their leading scorer. Clem Lachlan. They had a hell of a team. They had their goaltender was a man named Harry Holmes, and he went by nickname Happy, and he was one of only two players in Stanley Cup history to win four Stanley Cups with four different teams, the other being Jack Marshall. But Harry Holmes won with the Toronto Arenas in 1918, Toronto Blue Shirts in 1914, Toronto Arenas 1918, and Seattle Metropolitans 1917, and the Victoria Cougars 1925.
Wow. That's awesome.
Okay, Liam, you're going to give us Rusty's career in the NHL. From the year he started. Now, again, there's no heads up here, okay?
Well, first of all,
Rusty. You knew Rusty was on the show, so.
Yeah, I mean, look at the guy played in the 89 final. Right, you were talking earlier about Russ playing for the two iconic teams, Montreal and Toronto. There's only been three guys to lead Montreal and Toronto in scoring, and Russ is one of them. And a teammate of his, Vinny Damfus, is one of the others. And Vinny Damfus led three different teams in scoring, all Canadian teams in three successive years, which is one of the most unique accomplishments in history. But Russ... 89 finals. I mean, there's been 300 brother combinations to play in NHL history, 47 that have played together. Russ and Jeff briefly played together in Vancouver. Jeff won a Stanley Cup with Edmonton in 1988, but most people remember him always with the Canucks and his run. Jeff, that is, in 1994, he was absolutely outstanding for the Canucks then. But as I said, I watched Russ play, wore number six after Pierre Mondeau. Oleg Petrov got it after Russ left. He started the Toronto Maple Leafs wearing number 26, then 16, then 9, got the iconic 9, which will ever be remembered. He wore it as well as the legends that it's been retired and honored for in Toronto. I think that's an amazing accomplishment. I think the fact that he led both Montreal and Toronto in points is an amazing accomplishment. I think the fact that he got a hat trick, his only penalty shot goal came in a hat trick against Detroit, I believe in 1991, Tim Cheveldae. He got the third goal was a penalty shot, if I'm not mistaken, Russ.
Yeah.
And that's an incredibly unique accomplishment in NHL history. Some of the teammates, some of the guys you played with, the Hound Line, I mean, you look at Gary Lehman, who was... I'm sure still a friend of yours to this day. I mean, not only was he a teammate, but you guys were together on the same line. Gary Lehman holds one of the most unique distinctions in hockey history. I mean, there's been over 8,000 guys to dress for at least one game since 1917, and only one man has improved his point total in seven consecutive seasons, and that's Gary Lehman, and he did it while playing with Russ Courtnell. And I think that's absolutely outstanding, you know, outstanding stats right there that supplant Russ's career, let alone his brother's. So, you know, Jeff, numbers are a little bit better. But, I mean, like I said, Russ always pissed me off that when the NHL All-Star Game does their skills contest, they should take the winners from the respective teams and take those top numbers. I would have loved to seen your time around the rink. I mean, you were the fastest player in the league when you played. There was no doubt about that. And you were 90 point seasons, playing on the Hound line, finished with the Los Angeles Kings, I believe. You know, you had some good runs with a number of other teams. You were with Wayne in New York, if I'm not mistaken. So I know your career pretty good. And like I said, I was in the building when you scored against Hartford, and I jumped about 16 feet when you got that goal. So I remember that vividly. I was at so many playoff games. By then, I was working a ton in Montreal. I was doing a lot of radio. Dick Irvin used to have a show called Hockey Magazine, a TV show that preceded Hockey Night in Canada. And I was a regular guest on there from 1984 to 1991. So during the time that you were with the Habs, you wouldn't have probably seen it, but Yvon Cornway watched it one time.
I didn't have cable.
Right. It was too cheap to order cable.
No, 4 years. Seriously, four years I lived there. The first three, I didn't have cable. The fourth year, I got it because I met my wife. We were engaged, and she'd come visit, and she had to have TV. So that was the only time I had cable, was my last year.
There you go. Yeah. And it was on, it would have been on CFCF. You would have needed cable to get it. So, yeah. But I mean, the late Randy Thiemann, you must remember, a longtime broadcaster in Montreal. He brought me to Montreal in 1983 to do radio because he had come from Ottawa and heard me on Ottawa radio station CFRA, which you know very well, Jimmy. Yep. And I used to do the Hal Anthony show and the Lowell Green show, and Randy Thiemann heard me on there and brought me to Montreal, and I started doing radio in Montreal. I met Dick Irvin. He brought me on TV. I started getting gigs, including I got gigs for the Habs. I mean, Fred Steer. Do you ever meet Fred Steer, Russ?
Oh, yeah. I've got a good story about Fred.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you tell that because Fred hired me. Like, he orchestrated the Canadians hiring me to come down and work events for the month, like specifically for the Habs, events that I got to work because Fred was a big fan of mine on radio and TV, doing the hockey trivia stuff and the Montreal Canadian stuff. So it was, I really only met him the one time personally, but I figured you would know the name, and I'd love to hear the story.
Fred had a bottle of scotch in his drawer upstairs. He was the accountant for the CFO for the Montreal Canadiens. And
I like where it's starting. I like where this is starting.
Well, when you're on the road, you got to pay for your incidentals. The hotel's paid for. So when you check out, you just got to pay for whatever room charges you had. And back then we didn't have cell phones. So usually it was room service and a phone bill.
Right.
And we were in Edmonton, and I might've met somebody, and we went back to the hotel, and rather than go to my room, I went up to the front desk and said, is there any rooms that I can buy for the night? And sure. The guy says, oh, I'm sorry, we only have one room left, it's the presidential suite. And I said, well, how much is that? And he goes, and that back then I think the rooms were like $75 to $85 a night, and was at the old Westin. And the guy said, it's $450. I go, I'll take it. So we go up to the room, ordered two cheeseburgers and french fries, and had a great time back in Montreal. Didn't check out the next day. Didn't pay for anything.
Right.
So it's a Friday. We're back in Montreal. I can't remember. Maybe a week after. And he's paying for all the stuff. And he calls down to the locker room, and it's Shipper, who you mentioned. The trainer comes up to me. Goes, Fred wants to talk to you. So. I get on the phone. I said, hey, Fred, what's up? He goes, Edmonton, I got a room charge here. Your name's on it. And I'd like to see you after practice. So I'd never been to his office before. I went upstairs, and he sits down. He puts a glass in front of me and a glass in front of him, pours a scotch. And he says, this story better be good, and I want to hear everything, because if it's not, you're paying for the room and the cheeseburgers.
Oh, that's awesome.
I told him the whole story. Wow. And he said, okay, that's great. We'll take care of it.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. That is the best. Rusty, where you been with that one? Oh, that's great.
You see, you need a trigger, right? Like,
there you go.
This is what, as Jimmy can attest.
I'll give you the visual. Watch the movie Pretty Woman. That's the usual.
Wait a minute. Okay. Let's pause for that for a second.
Okay.
Then. Oh, yeah. Good one. Okay. I got it. All right. I got it.
Yeah. That kind of lends.
Russ wore a red dress.
Oh, it was good. But that's Fred. He was such a great guy. And we had a deferral program there to help with taxes and trying to keep American players at the time, because in Quebec, the taxes were really high, the dollar was really weak, and so they were trying to figure ways of keeping players. So we were able to defer money for up to 10 years, I think it was, and then you had to pay the taxes at the end. But I met with Fred, and he walked me through it, and he told me, you know, I was 23 years old, and he said, this is a really good investment for you. And it was great. I deferred 50% of my salary each year. And then nice. I got it out 10 years later, and the Molson family guaranteed the money. And then I built my house in Victoria with that money. And, Fred was such a great guy. I love Fred. He was a wonderful man, and obviously he did great things for Montreal. I don't know how long he worked for Montreal, but he was with them a long time.
Right. Yeah. And that house you're talking about, Russ, because I've been there. I jammed with Kid Rock in your backyard. It was a small little 800 square foot thing in the inner city. Okay. Wait a minute. No, I got that wrong. It was 8,000 square feet on the Pacific Ocean. That was
Just a reminder, if you'd like to connect online with Russ or Jimmy or engage with them on social media, find out how at thesuspendables.com.
Liam, tell us why Montreal is really one of the most, I use the word iconic, of course, one of the most successful and storied franchises in all of sports. I've heard you say that before. Like I say, we're celebrating Montreal. They're about to tip off round three. Talk about them, Liam. Talk about Montreal and what they are in the world of sports.
One reason only, Jimmy, the winning. I mean, you know, when you have that type of pedigree, especially over the length of time that they were able to accomplish it, that's going to resonate both historically and with generations as they live it immediately, and then as you put it in the rearview mirror, because then the next one's coming along and they're finding ways to win as well. Really, the Ottawa Senators were the first dynasty in the NHL, the old Ottawa Senators team. They won the Stanley Cup in 1920, 21, and 23. The NHL started in 17, 18. What a lot of people don't know is the NHL was just one of 14 different leagues that competed for the Stanley Cup. When you won the NHL in those days, you didn't win the Stanley Cup. Russ said earlier, he knew Victoria won in 25, his hometown. They weren't in the NHL. They were in the PCHL, Pacific Coast Hockey League. So when you won the NHL, then you went on and you had to play the winner of two other leagues for a number of years to win the Stanley Cup. So when the Canadians came in 1909 in the NHA, which was a forerunner of the NHL, then they were one of the inaugural teams in the NHL. And then they won their first Stanley Cup in 1916. They went to the final in 1917. And they were in the NHL final in 1918. They nothing special about that really in any of those instances. And then they got Joe Malone that first year because of Schmozzle. Quebec couldn't operate that first year, and then he's the first scoring leader in the NHL. So he'll forever have that. The Canadians will, and he will. Joe Malone, 44 goals, 20 games, member of the Montreal Canadiens. Then they go from him to Newsy Lalonde, and then they pick up Howie Morin. They win that Stanley Cup in 1924. And Howie Morenz is not a Quebec guy. He's an Ontario kid. He came, he signed his contract 2 days after Leo Dandrin's birthday, which was July 7th. He signed it on July 9th, 1923. And that's why he took number 7. They said, my birthday was just a couple days ago. Why don't you take 7? Well, Odie Claghorn wears 7. Oh, he'll give it up for you. So he gave up 7, and Howie took 7. That's why he took 7. The Canadians win the cup in 24. They lose to Russ's Victoria Cougars in 25. And they're one of the stronger teams in the NHL, but they're not winning in 26, it's the Montreal Maroons. In 27, it's the Ottawa Senators again. In 28, it's the New York Rangers. 29, Boston Bruins. Then they win again in 30 and 31 when Morenz and Joliet are really kicking ass. But again, still at that point, they're just another really good team like Ottawa, like Toronto, like the Montreal Maroons, like others in the NHL at that time. When things turned, for the Habs was specifically three things in the 1940s. Number one, Conn Smythe fired Frank Selke Sr. He fired him because he made a trade when Conn was overseas fighting in the Second World War. Second tour of duty, by the way. He also served in the First World War. So he's overseas. Frank Selke Sr. trades Ted Kennedy, the rights to Ted Kennedy. The Habs had Ted Kennedy, if you can believe that. And they trade his rights to Toronto for a guy named Frankie Edels. One of the greatest trades that nobody talks about in hockey history. And Conn Smythe was so pissed off, he fires Frank Selke Sr. Montreal Canadiens, Tommy Gorman, hires him immediately. They hire Frank Selke Sr. He starts working for the Habs in 46. What's the first person he hires is this up-and-coming guy running midget teams in Montreal named Sam Pollock. And he hires Sam Pollock in 1947. And Frank Selke went to Sam Pollock and said, what we have to do is to build a network of players that we can call upon to bring up. We're always shorthanded. Everybody's always shorthanded when our stars go down and we're scrambling. And he said, think of it as a farm where you have, you know, you cultivate a crop. And that's the origin of the term, the farm system in hockey. Frank Selke Sr. So Frank Selke Sr. and Sam Pollock started building a crop of players. See, in those days, it was no draft. You had to sign with an NHL team, and you signed either an A, a B, or a C form, and they all determined what level of rights the NHL team had for you. For example, Jean Béliveau signed a B form with the Montreal Canadiens, not the standard C form. Why? His father said, Jean, sign the B so you can stay in Quebec and still earn money playing hockey. The Montreal Canadiens cannot control your rights if you sign the B. So he signed the B. And the only way the Montreal Canadiens got Jean Béliveau was they bought the league. They bought the entire league and turned it professional, meaning that Jean Béliveau could no longer play for the Quebec Aces. So he had no choice but to sign with the Montreal Canadiens. And Frank Selke Sr. said one of the greatest quotes in hockey history. He went, when he was told after, how'd you sign Jean Béliveau? He said, very easy. I brought him in the office. I opened up the vault. And I said, help yourself. And swear to God. And that's how Jean Béliveau became, at that time, the highest paid player in the NHL. And then Gordie Howe and Rocket Richard had their contracts renegotiated right away so they could make $5,000 more than Jean Béliveau, because Jean went right away to $25,000 a year, and the Rocket and Gordie went up to $30,000 a year, and that was in 1953. So the Canadians rolled from there, man. They picked up Scotty Bowman after he suffered his head injury. He played a couple more years after that. Jean-Guy Talbot stuck him in the head, like almost decapitated him in a junior game. Scotty played a little bit more and then retired, got into coaching. He got in. He was a Montreal native, obviously. He knew Sam Pollock. Sam hired him. So think of this. You had Frank Selke Sr., Sam Pollock, and Scotty Bowman in the same organization. This was after they had brought Frank Selke in the 40s. They win that cup in 44 and 46. They win in 53. They hammer the five together in the 60s. They're rocking. Five more finals in the 60s with four more cups. Now you get into the 1970s. You know, in the 1950s, they made the finals 10 years in a row. 10 years in a row. And they won six Stanley Cups. Now, that's all because of Frank Selke Sr. I'll just finish on this point, then back to you, Jimmy and Russ.
I am.
I'm throwing it back to you because this is important, because there's a lot of people listening right now that are probably want to offer up a comment about the French-Canadian rule. Now, I took 7 years, parts and pieces of my life, to write what I feel is a definitive story on the origin, historical, and factual origin of the French-Canadian rule such as it was. There's one line in every NHL guide and record book that says the Montreal Canadiens had the rights to French-Canadian-speaking players for three seasons from 1936 to 1939. Now, my research showed that's actually from 36 to 43. But what it doesn't say, and what the haters and the people who believe it has an urban legend, because I say to people all the time, well, where'd you hear that? Oh, my dad told me. Where'd he hear it? Well, his dad told him. Yeah, and let me guess, you guys hate
Jim
the Habs.
Jerome. He's the fat guy.
Somebody somewhere with the name Jerome started it. Yeah. But the bottom line is that you could not sign anybody if they had previously signed with another NHL team. That's how they weren't able to get. When I interviewed Marcel Pronovost, at the draft in Florida, this was a draft where Jason Spezza was taken. I was there. I was at that draft. I interviewed Marcel Pronovost specifically about this. And he said, Liam, the Detroit Red Wings came to our house and they gave my father a $100 bill. We had never seen one before. We had never seen a $100 bill before. This was his signing bonus with Detroit. The Canadians came knocking a week later, say, Marcel, yeah, we'd like to secure your rights. You're from the province of Quebec. You're French speaking. Too late. Sign with Detroit. Go F yourself.
So Liam, sorry to interrupt. Just so we not understand, what's the French-Canadian rule? What are you talking about when you say
The reason I'm saying it, Jimmy, is because I guarantee you got listeners while I was going through that spiel about the history of the Habs and why they're one of the most revered teams in sports history is obviously because of their winning. And there's people who think that their winning was largely synonymous with the fact that they had the benefit of taking the top two French-Canadian players out of the province of Quebec. In some cases, they think for eternity, yet right. The rule only began in 1930. It was a rule because the Canadians nearly folded. The NHL nearly folded. The Depression killed the NHL, right? There was 10 teams. The NHL was a 10-team, two-division league in the late 1920s, early 1930s. So they helped each other where they could. Like the Ottawa Senators, when they folded, they went to St. Louis and tried to survive in St. Louis for years, the St. Louis Eagles. So what they did with the Canadians, they said, okay, we got to help the Habs. What can we do? Well, if we can get some bums in the seats, we need people to pay whatever they can afford. 50 cents a ticket, doesn't matter. We need bums in the seats. Let's get French-Canadian guys on the roster. So they went to the Canadians and said, here, you can take any two French-Canadian guys, but as long as they haven't signed with any other team, you understand? We can't have that. So, so that was the rule. And then in 1963, it was reinstated. Sam Pollock and Frank Selke Sr. got it back on the books for 6 years, from 63 to 69. And not one single guy between 63 and 67 that Montreal Canadiens, they didn't even take anybody in those 4 years. They finally took Michel Place and then Réjean Houle and Mark Tardif in 69 was the last two guys that they were allowed to take under this rule. So the Canadiens, you ask Jimmy why they're revered as they are with the Yankees and Liverpools and these great Boston
Lakers,
Celtics. And
yeah,
for sure. The LA Lakers and these teams. Look, when you've got a history of 40 to 50 years of winning, you're spawning generations. You're spawning, decades of winning. And then you're doing it with the players you're talking about. Look at who their Mount Rushmore is. Howie Morenz, Rocket Richard, Jean Béliveau, and Guy Lafleur. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, like that's their Mount Rushmore. So, there's some other teams that could put some names up for sure. But I mean, that's four names that's pretty tough to beat in hockey history. And that spawns Howie Morenz in 1923 to Guy Lafleur, last playing for the Canadiens in 1984. And that's a hell of a long time, Jimmy. That's 61 years spanning those four careers. And they won almost every one of their Stanley Cups, with the exception of the first one in 1916, and the last two in 86 and 93. Right. So 21 of their 24 cups were won in the time span of those four guys.
Okay, Liam, drop and give me 40 right now, Liam. Rusty, you played in Montreal, and when you hear Liam talk about this thing, it's fantastic, Liam. This is a great thing to, hard to keep up with all the stats, but it gives the listener today, when they watch Montreal tee off, what that franchise really is and was and will remain to be. There's no doubt about it, right? Mm-hmm. Rusty, when you ended up in Montreal, does someone pull you aside and say, okay, there's the obvious here. You know, you're part of a team, blah, 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 blah. We're pretty good. We're going to win. But does someone give you a history lesson there, Russ, and go, do you understand what franchise you're playing for here now, as opposed to a mini or a Dallas?
Well, when I came from Toronto, and Harold was living in the building, running the show, and I love Harold, and he was great to my family, he was great to me, and he had some older guys, older Leafs that were working for him, didn't have a huge staff. And I go to Montreal, Sir Savard greets me, calls me into his office. I couldn't believe it. It was like I walked into, Yikes. It was unbelievable, like the difference. It was six older guys smoking in Toronto in the office. And then you get to Harold's office, which was in the back. And here it was like corporate headquarters. I mean, it was unbelievable, the difference and the professionalism. And so Serge calls me in, explains how the Montreal Canadiens work. He opens up my contract and he says, "This, your bonuses aren't going to work here in Montreal." And he says they're all individual bonuses. We're a team-based bonus team. So if you win the first round, you're going to get this and this and this and that. And if we win the cup, you're going to get that. And he just rips up my contract and goes, like it was an addendum, right? Stapled onto the back. And he goes, those don't work here. And he just ripped them up. Like didn't call my agent, nothing. Just said, they didn't, you know, these bonuses do not work here. So he goes, you play well, you'll get paid well here. We pay our players very well. You'll find that out. Your contract's up after this year. And sure enough, he paid me great and treated me really well. So that was a big difference. Was it was a team. They were just such a team orientated, all for one, one for all, and that's why I believe they had such success.
When you hear that, Liam, do you know in your mind whatever the fuck is up going on up there, man? do you know stories, Liam, of Montreal Canadiens contracts that were signed by guys that we wouldn't know, and how they, when you hear that Serge Savard story, well, yeah. First of all, Russ, what did you think when he just grabbed this contract and tore it up for you?
Well, he's a massive human being. So I was, you know, at that time I was probably about 178 pounds, maybe.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting and I was just, you know, you get traded and it's a restart, you know, for my career because things weren't going well in Toronto at the time. And so I wasn't going to say shit. And, you know, they moved me quickly from center to right wing. I never said anything. I just was like, God, I want to get back on track. And this team's winning and I have a shot at winning the cup. And I was just so happy that I didn't really care. And, I was just trying to rediscover myself and I did. Right. And then they paid me accordingly and I couldn't complain. I had two contracts. I signed one that year and then signed one more. And both times, Montreal, you'd never hear Montreal or Calgary at that in the 80s complain about how much the players were getting paid when everybody else was complaining they weren't getting enough. Montreal and Calgary were both paying their players very well. And that's why those teams had success. They, you know, in the late 80s, they won, Calgary beat us and Montreal won two cups. So they were the two of the best teams in the league at that time.
Right. What were those bonuses, Russ? Like your individual
20 goals, 30 goals, 40 goals, assists, points, individual awards. If you won the Conn Smythe or some, you know, it was just all award based, you know,
club championship.
Bonuses for playoffs. So, you know, there's all kinds of stuff, but the individual like goals and assists just didn't work in Montreal. So
do they do them anymore, Rusty? Have you heard of them anymore? Like,
I would assume they do. I would assume they do. And I think that's a one way that the rookies can make up for their, the salary cap, the entry level contracts that they've converted to, since the Lindros days, when they were getting massive contracts, they brought in the new, rookie cap or whatever it's called, entry level contracts. Well, a way to pay these great young players is bonuses. So, you know, I've heard comments like, you know, if the kid has a heartbeat, he's going to freaking make a couple million bucks. But that's a joke, but the bonuses are very achievable and you know, it's a way for them to make more money. But I don't know too much about it
anymore. Okay. Stevie just put Liam on the oxygen. He's all done. He's got the mask off. All right. Okay. McGuire, we're talking about contracts there.
Yeah. I've done a few gigs with Dick Duff. He went in the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2003, I believe. And he came from Toronto, through New York to Montreal. And it's unbelievable. This is like 21, 22 years before Russ. And the story is almost identical.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's unfreaking believable. If you listen to Dick Duff talk about the difference, and this was a Leaf team that, you know, was a pretty strong team. I mean, they, Dick played with them when they went to the finals, lost the late 50s Habs, and then he was with them. In fact, he scored a Stanley Cup winning goal for them in those early 60s run. And of course, he came to the Canadiens. They were powerhouse and they were becoming one at the time, and he won Stanley Cups with them as well. But hearing Russ talk about that transition was so similar to listening to Dick Duff talk. And I've heard others say the same. It's not to denigrate Toronto necessarily, but I think it's just a difference the way Montreal, and it goes back to your question, Jimmy, really. I mean, what is one of the things that makes the Canadiens stand out? I've said this for years. If you're strong off the ice, you'll be strong on the ice. Look at the shit show here in Ottawa. They've got an owner that makes Harold Ballard look like a choir boy. Right. This guy won't even do Ottawa media anymore. He goes on Toronto media. Tell me another owner that goes on media and says, well, we need a frontline center. We need a starting left D. We're going to be okay. We're going to move this guy. We're going to move that guy. I mean, there's no other owner that does that. And, you know, I think in Montreal for years anyway, and I said earlier, I extended that to 84. You can certainly extend that right through because through Serge Savard's tenure as a general manager, which goes right through to 94, and obviously would include the time Russ was there. And, you know, you think about that trade. I mean, you know, John Brophy. And that's I do have a funny story, Russ, about the night I met you. The first time.
Okay.
It sounds like just based on how this interview's gone that this would probably be okay to tell.
We'll decide that, Liam, after. We got an editor, pal, so let it fly.
Go ahead. Yeah, okay. Anyways, I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school here, but Russ, you were with the Leafs still, and this was on a Sunday. You had played at home in Toronto. You were coming in. You were playing the Habs on a Monday, so you guys were in Montreal on the Sunday, and Luke Richardson, a former teammate of yours, is a very good friend of mine.
Yeah,
and we went in. I was in Montreal for a big hockey draft with Randy Thiemann and Rob Folds and all those guys and Dick Irvin and everybody. And me and a bunch of friends went out to a bar after Montreal called Thursdays.
And yeah, shocker.
We ran into Luke, and Luke's in there with a bunch of the Leafs, including Russ. And he introduced us, and you guys were well on your way. You were playing the next night, so it wasn't like that night or anything. But we quickly joined you and tried to catch up, really. And we're pounding the pints back. Now, this was just a couple weeks before the trade, you for Kordic.
Wow.
And you were absolutely livid with even the mention of the name John Brophy.
Yeah.
So much so that this old guy walked in the bar, and this about 11:30 or midnight, and he was way over on the other side, and you just turned and you went, "Is that him?" And you went flying over there, and you were going to grab him, and you know who grabbed you? Boreas Salming.
Oh, I remember this now. Yeah, yeah.
Boreas Salming, in fact, him and Bill Dorlego, I believe, assisted your first ever goal against the New York Islanders. Billy Smith, 9-5 loss. Date was March 8th, if I'm not mistaken. And you went flying over there.
Backhand slap pass by Boreas. had the empty net.
Wasn't Boreas all awesome?
Yeah, he's the best.
He pulled you off that guy.
Yeah.
And a couple weeks later, you were traded.
So Rusty, Brophy obviously walks into the bar, right?
I don't know if it was Brof.
So why are you running at the guy?
I was going to go confront him. And then I think Boreas just put me in a headlock, goes, "You're not going anywhere. Just stay here." I didn't. Yeah. So I never confronted anyone. No. I was ready to go over and give him shit.
Luke Richardson helped as well to try and calm you down. And
well, it wasn't hard. I was probably about 173, 4 pounds soaking wet.
Anyway, I met you that night, man, at that Thursdays, that Sunday, and we had a great time. I had a long chat with Boreas Salming that night, talking about him growing up in Sweden in the 72 Summit Series, because a lot of people don't know or forget that Canada played two games against Sweden, and that's where Jim Gregory and these guys, they saw Salming and Hammerstrom and Hedberg and Nielsen and Tommy Sjöberg and Tommy Bergman and all these guys were in one or both of those games. And that's how many of them ended up coming to North America, the WHA or the NHL or the Toronto Maple Leafs in that case of Boreas and Inga. And, you know, I mean, well, his legacy is certainly well noted and documented and deserved, but that he was there that night. And I always remember it because he was a class act, man.
So Liam, explain to people how you're able to do this. Everything we've just heard over the last half hour is amazing. It's incredible. It's interesting. It's informative. It's mind blowing. And it's a great reminder for a guy like me, how little I know about the NHL, you know, when you run into a guy who makes his living out of it. So if I gave you a year, Liam, if I gave you the year I was, I think you told me one time, I need a number, Jimmy. I need the year. And then it just goes on and on and on from there. And so I was born, Liam, November 26th in 1961.
Yeah.
So when you hear that, what happens to you, Liam, when you're doing this hockey thing?
Well, like I said, and it's not just the year. I don't have a photographic memory, but I have an extremely good memory. And especially with numbers, if I want to burn in a number, I seem to have the ability to burn in a number. But I use what's called the umbrella technique, which is used by most kids who study from whether it's high school, college, university. You need the tip of the umbrella to give you your starting point. So it can be a year, it can be a name, could be a team, could be a game, could be a moment, whatever you want to ask me about. Underneath it, I will build as the umbrella spreads out, as you unfold an umbrella, you spread it out. I can do the same with when you give me a year. So I take the first thing, I take 1961. As I say, it's the basis of everything for me is who won the Stanley Cup. Because why do guys play the game? They played a game to win the cup. You know, you say what you want. Jeff Courtnell, you know, played a secondary role at the Edmonton Oilers in 1988. Guess what? He's got a Stanley Cup ring, you know? So, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you'll never be able to take that away from him. 1961, Chicago Blackhawks won the Stanley Cup. They beat Detroit in the final in six games. Cup winning goal was scored by Ab McDonald. Score of the final game was 5-1. So he got the second goal. Ab McDonald played on the scooter line, the original one, with Kenny Warham and Stan Mikita on Chicago. He was a Montreal native, actually, I believe, originally. And then, anyway, that's the first thing. In November, so your birthday's 4 days after Yvon Cornouet's, my favorite player of all time. Yvon Cornouet's birthday is November 22nd. So that would trigger me right away to bounce to Cornouet, you know, November 22nd. Well, you know, November 22nd, of course, is the date of the Kennedy assassination as well. Such an important date in global history. You know, right. What happened in Dallas that day in 63. Cornouet was born November 22nd, 1943. And then I would go from there with Yvon and talk about, you know, I could right. build under there. Or I could go from 1961, your birth year, which is the same day as Wayne, right? And so you could go Wayne, which is January 26th, your November 26th. So then it would bounce on to Wayne. Well, then, my God, wait, where you go.
Not much there.
But the one that should be always noted about Wayne is the 1851 connection. I'm the first guy to come up with it. Bob McKenzie printed it in the Hockey News after. I've got it in my books. Wayne Gretzky scored his first ever goal in the NHL October 14th, 1979, against the Vancouver Canucks and goaltender Glenn Hanlon. His goal tied the game at 4, and it was scored at the 1851 mark of the third period.
No, it wasn't.
Assisted by, yeah, it was. Assisted by Brett Callaghan and Blair McDonald. 10 years and one day later, October 15th, 1989, Wayne Gretzky, now a member of the Los Angeles Kings, playing against his former team, the Edmonton Oilers, scores a goal to tie the game that passes Gordie Howe for the most career points in NHL history. And the number of points, 1,851. The exact same number as the time of his first goal 10 years and one day earlier.
Isn't that crazy? I never knew that.
Oh, that's amazing.
Fuck, I haven't been listening to you, Liam. You probably told me that before.
Oh, no. Jimmy, I remember one time you and I sat down, drilled back about a dozen Sambucas, and I told you that story.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Just so the fans know that, you know, on October 17th, 1988, when we first met.
Yeah.
Actually, we met on the 16th.
We met on the 16th because you played Montreal on the 17th. You guys won 6-2.
6-2, baby. We were guilty. We might have been guilty, fans, but we won.
You won. You won. You lost on the Saturday, if I'm not mistaken. If you're not mistaken, I think the Leafs lost. I can't remember.
Yeah, 5-3.
Was it Buffalo?
No, Detroit.
Detroit.
I had to look up this, what you're talking about. So I went on Wikipedia and we won. We beat the Montreal Canadiens 6-2.
Yeah, smoked and them then, on a Monday night in the Forum.
And then we went on a run, and that's when I got traded. Like, so we were 3-3 against when we lost to Detroit on October 15th. Then we beat Montreal. Then we beat Buffalo, Detroit, and tied Calgary. And then I think I got traded after the Islanders 4-3, 7-3. I think they were 7-3-1 when they traded me.
You were traded on November 7th. I remember the date.
Oh, November. Oh, later than that then.
You don't know anything about yourself, Russ. Okay, you can get
Leo. Oh, no, we were We were 8-6-1. So yeah, it was after losing to the Kings 6-4. We'd lost three straight. So they made the big trade.
Yeah.
Their fault. Yeah. It was their fault.
Yeah. They needed Kordick to work that power play.
Right. Liam, talk about the ownership of the Habs. Does the Gillette family own them now?
No.
Is the Molson family the longest tenure of an ownership of any sports franchise?
I'm not sure about any sports franchise. That I'm not sure. Because Jeff is back, and he's owned them now for a number of years. But Jeff there was Molson, a gap there.
Yeah.
I mean, Seagram's. And
he bought it for $575 million off the Gillette.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, and even the Molsons themselves, they only bought the franchise in the 1950s. I mean, it was a Canadian arena company. If you go back, it was owned by the Montreal Canadiens in their first years in the NHL, and in the 1920s were owned by, you know, a collection of men, a number of men who were the owners at the time, and that stayed that way really for a number of years. The Molson family came in the 50s, I believe, as owners, but so they don't have that going back to say the Howie Morenz days or things of that nature, but they do obviously have a hell of a history,
right?
And anybody who remembers watching Hockey Night in Canada in the 70s when there was no glass and fans used to walk actually on the bench, you know, right. At the end of periods and stuff, and guys were unbelievable. And Don Cherry used to hate it, but you know, you could see David Molson sitting there in his seat. I mean, the Molson family always, they had the same seats, and they sat there all the time, and they were an institution there for sure.
Okay, we had a little breakdown there. Now Liam, feel my pain, okay? As we come back on the little edit point here. Feel my pain, okay? Rusty's gone, okay? Rusty's gone, okay? He's had enough, Rust. Okay, Liam? He's had enough.
It blew his brain.
Yeah, he lasted, I don't know. Liam, you've been in radio a long time. You know, you've been doing Zoom meetings and all that. Shit happens, right?
Yep.
And someone will say, oh, hang on, we got a glitch here. It's glitching, just stand by. Everyone's prepared for, this might take 5 or 10 minutes, okay? Everyone's prepared. Rusty's threshold for that, Liam? I don't know, about 28 seconds. Okay, yeah. That's what happened with Rusty. I'm out. He's gone. So we had some trouble, and Rusty's computer is down. You were talking about the Molson family, Liam. Of course, Hartland was, the senator, Senator Molson. He was a senator when my dad was a member of parliament. And I'll tell you a quick story, because I ended up working for Molson. That's how I came out west.
Right.
I drove a van in the summers in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And the family was great. And we met a bunch of them. And I ended up getting a job here. Crimea River, 1985. By the way, kid, you're going to look after the Oilers. Yeah, but what are they doing these days? Come on. Okay. And you know dates. So there was a guy, they were celebrating a lunch for a longtime salesman in Calgary, a guy named Stuart. And he could have been promoted all these years, but he loved his gig, Liam, okay? Think of a guy like Jack Kilray, okay, who worked in Ottawa for years, had his territory, never wanted to be promoted, didn't want, you know, just leave me alone, okay? I'm going to work 4,000 years here, and I'm quite happy. And this guy was doing that, okay? He was in his, you know, they were celebrating 30 years of his life or something, and he never went on further than being a sales guy. Hartland Molson came out for this lunch. And so Stewie jumped in the limo and went out to the airport to pick him up, Hartland. And Stewie was pretty deep by then, okay? He was probably 8 or 9 beers in. And Hartland Molson is the number one shareholder of Molson at the time. Stewie is celebrating 25 years as a sales rep in downtown Calgary. And he gets in the car, Hartland gets in the car, and Stewie goes, "And welcome, Senator." He's a little hammered. He goes, "You know, Senator, I need to tell you something. You and I have gone about as far as we're ever going to go with this company." Liam, I recall a Molson kid playing in the NHL. Was any of the family, any relation to the family ever end up playing in the league? Do you know?
No, not to my knowledge. I never knew of any offspring or nephew.
There's a kid. Stevie, look it up. There was a kid, Molson, who played in the NHL.
Although it was Matt Molson with a U, but not M-O-L-S-O-N.
Oh, gotcha.
Maybe there was. I don't recall one, but not. He wouldn't have been a relative of theirs. But
anyway, okay, not that interesting. Yeah. So, Liam, I've got a question for you because I always feel sorry for you. To be honest with you, with what you've done as a kid, right? This started out. I don't remember seeing you in high school because I was only there for. I went in grade 11, so you were probably gone by then, right?
I was in 13 when you were in 11.
Yeah, and you talked about carrying around this notebook, watching games, feverishly watching games or writing stuff down.
Yeah.
And then we get a great taste of what you're all about over the last 45 minutes. But I've always said, Jesus, careful what you wish for, Liam. You've been on Off the Record 20 times. You've written books. You've done, numerous appearances, thousands of radio shows and everything else. And because you deserve it, it's an incredible talent. But what are you going to do going forward, Liam? Now that you've set the table here, pick a date, Jimmy. And I know you and I are born in the 60s and I know your passion for loving the history, but what are you going to do every year now, Liam? Now it's 2021. Do you sit down at the end of a night each after a hockey game is played and to try and record stuff, or are you done? Are you done? Is your deal? Look, I'll take you right up to 2000, boys, and then fuck off. I'm not doing anything more. Talk about that. What's your plan going forward?
The pandemic shut down a lot of work for me, as I think it did for you, because you speak a ton still and
right.
Big gigs and whatnot. And many of us in the business, that it's, for me, it's been 90% of my income for the last number of years since I was last with any type of radio contract, for sure, that had any substantiability to it. So, what do I do current day? I still follow it. I'm watching everything I can. I know Tampa won the cup last year. I know Braden Point got the cup winning goal. I know they beat Dallas in the final. I know the bubble, the situation there. So I'll take out of it. Their overtime game against Columbus, mm-hmm. You'll take out of it what I feel I need to, but the phones are a game changer, Jimmy, really for the gigs that I still get hired to do now with the cell phones. So before, as I do now with the tip of the umbrella, and I could say, ask me any decade and I'll tell you who won the cup every year. So we can dispense with the formalities here. I'll just give you all 10 years in a row. Just pick a decade. Well, big deal. You can look on your phone now and find that in 5 seconds. So now I give you the rest of the story. And I think that's where my strength lies now, in that now, when I first started doing all this, I professionally where I earned a dollar, I was 22 years old. I'm 62 now. That's 40 years. So I've changed the act, and I now give the rest of the story. And I think I do it in an entertaining fashion with a lot of passion and a lot of knowledge. And I have my opinions. I still follow the game. I played the game at some level of competitiveness till I was 24. I coached my son for 13 years and I still follow the game structurally. So I have that. And then historically, I don't think there's anybody who can do what I can do. I've never met or heard of anybody else who can stand in front of a crowd of 20 people or 2000 and entertain them the way that I do. So I still do that. I've also got work waiting for me as soon as the pandemic ends. I've been hired by Rideau-Carlton Raceway, which here is a staple part of the Ottawa landscape. They have been bought by the Hard Rock Cafe. And they've been gutted inside. They've built three brand new, two restaurants and a lounge upstairs. And I've been hired as the in-house MC. It's just an absolutely fabulous gig and career move for me. And also been, I don't have a signed contract with them, but I've formally connected with Brad Jones from Jones Entertainment. And once the pandemic again does lift and the world comes up for air, I'll be doing as few as 10 and as many as 12 to 15 events across North America for him, all hockey related. So, it's the same old, Jimmy. If you're hired to entertain, then go up and entertain. And I think I can entertain. I entertained Gretzky and Gordie Howe at the fantasy camp, and Grant Fuhr and Larry Robinson and everybody else that was there that day, Paul Coffey and all the rest, And I've entertained people at the Manitic Legion. So it's all relative. I don't take a shift or a night off ever. I never have. I never will. And I'll take that to my grave, take that to my grave. I can do that. So that's what's next for me, pal. Same old, same old. Just keep on rocking. I'm in good shape mentally and physically, and I'm good to go.
I got to tell you a couple of stories, Liam, before we go. I think I've told you this before because it's my all-time favorite, and I know you would appreciate this more than anything. When we moved to Ottawa with my dad, he was the speaker, my dad was a massive hockey fan. In fact, my father played varsity hockey. I think I sent you a picture of his team.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And he was hanging out in those days with the Chief, George Armstrong, and Tim Horton, and a bunch of other guys that he hung out with. They were, as he says it, they tore tickets at Maple Leaf Gardens. That's what they did to make a few bucks. And he was a good hockey player. My dad was small, scrappy. And when I met Tim Horton, because a classmate of my dad's in law school was Tim Horton's lawyer. And Tim Horton opened one of his first Tim Horton restaurants that my dad's classmate was doing the legal work for, was in Sudbury. And so my dad said, come on, you got to meet this. You got to come and meet Tim Horton. You know, I was like, oh my God. Right. And so I walked up with my dad, and Tim Horton called my dad. He's C-Form, right?
Yeah.
And so did his law classmate. That was my dad's nickname, C-Form, right? And eventually when I was older, I said, what's that all about, Dad? C-Form, you know? And he explained it like you did earlier in the show. You signed either an A, B, or C-Form.
Right.
And a C-Form was a huge day in a player's life.
Absolutely.
That if they sign this freaking C-Form, you're in. You're owned by a team, right? I think. And I said, well, you didn't get owned by a team. You went to fucking law school. And he goes, yeah, the reason they called me that, because I was the least likely guy ever to sign a C-Form. So they called him C-Form. And we went to my dad took us to the form. He loved it. And we got to go down and watch the pregame skate. It was Boston and Montreal. It would probably be 1974, 1975. Kenny Dryden was playing. And Claude Mouton. Right.
Yep. Yep.
Liam was the great announcer.
Of course.
And he came over and you know, my dad was Honorable James, and he called him in this French accent, Mr. Honorable, right? He called him, and nice to meet you. And he waved his arm. They were doing a pregame warm-up. Okay. Both teams were on the ice. And he waved his hand over all the Montreal Canadiens. Right. And he looked at me and my brother Paul, Joey and Mary Lou, and he said, Ooh, would you like your picture with? And my brother fucking looks around the back of him and points to the other end and goes, Bobby Orr. My dad just about freaked, you know. Yeah, of course, you didn't do that before. Liam, this has been great, man. This is fantastic. Tell me, Liam, what would be of all the experiences you've had, and I think people get an idea now. They're gonna listen to this show going, oh my God. What is this guy's like Rain Man, for God's sakes, right? I'm sure you've been called a bunch of stuff. What's your greatest single experience, Liam, as a Montreal Habs fan?
Well, proposing at center ice would be a 1A or a B, and I'd say meeting Rocket Richard in November of 1989 and spending about a half hour talking to him. I was part owner of a sports bar in Ottawa called the Original Six for 3.5 years.
Right.
And we had the Rocket and Gordie Howe, Gump Worsley, and Eddie Shack in there. They were touring with a book that Gordie Howe's wife, Colleen, had ghostwritten. And Rocket and his wife were in the bar. And I sat with him for about 30 minutes. And that would be right there. I played a fairly substantial role on the Montreal Canadiens 100th anniversary DVD. I did the majority of the interviews. They also interviewed me on it. And that's definitely one of my highlights as well. I mean, a DVD to support the 100th anniversary of that franchise. You touched on it earlier with your question, what makes them have the legacy that they do. And when they put out their DVD to honor that legacy, I was hired to both be in front of the camera and behind the camera. And I was the only guy that had that distinction. And I think that's unbelievably cool as well. And the last thing for sure would be the fact that Yvon Cornouet, my favorite player of all time. I mean, the Montreal Canadiens swept the Winnipeg Jets just a few days ago. And my phone rang the next day. I was driving in to drop some stuff off in Ottawa for my brother, Sean. And my phone rang in my vehicle, and it's Yvon Cornouet phoning me.
Stop it.
How you feeling today, you know, after Montreal swept Winnipeg? So, you know, to have that type of friendship and relationship with a guy who he idolized as a kid,
right?
You know, is those four things, you know, I mean, I told you already about the forum, the building, the team and everything.
Do you have a keepsake, Liam? Do you have something that's been given to you? I've got, well, I don't anymore. Stevie has it, but Gretz gave me a jacket that was all the team got from Roots when they were in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And he gave me one of those jackets, and I can't pretend to be a collector. So Stevie has it. What's your number one thing that you have?
Well, I got a seat. I got a seat I sat in when the forum bus closed.
Seat. Oh, okay.
I bought a seat. As soon as you're talking Montreal Canadiens, you say you got a seat. Everybody, most people would automatically assume you mean a forum seat. No. And I sat in it in 1981. The Canadiens played the Minnesota North Stars, section 205, row B, seat 12. I got that exact seat. I have the ticket stub with it. And I put the four dates on it. And my dates are the date of my first game, May 1, 75. The date I was in the building when they won the Stanley Cup against the New York Rangers. I was there, May 21st, 1979. It was my last night ever as a teenager. I turned 20 the next day. The next day I turned 20. I was 19 years old. Then I put the date of that I got engaged, which was September 10, 93. And then I put the final date, which was Monday, March 11, 1996. And then I put Je me souviens, which is on the Quebec province license plates, which means I will remember.
Sure, sure.
And those are the four. So that seat and the fact I sat there, and it's probably my number. I've got a program from 1933, which is, you know, probably worth $4,000 or $5,000.
The year my dad was born, speaking of varsity players.
No kidding. No. Well, there you go.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the New York Rangers won the Stanley Cup, and they beat the Toronto Maple Leafs in the finals.
Cool. I'll tell you what, Liam, thanks a million for doing this, old friend. It really is a treat, and we got some history, and I love you to death, and I love what you're doing, and I love how you've stuck with it all these years through thick and thin and in and out of radio jobs and all that stuff that you've kept your verve, man, for the whole thing. Yesterday, Liam, I was brought to tears. I've got to admit, I love Djokovic, okay, the tennis player. I don't know if you saw it, and the French Open was on, and he's the coolest guy I've ever seen. Like, there's all sorts of videos of him talking to ball boys, sitting them down when they change ends at games, and drinking with them bottles of water. He's down love two in sets, and he wins the next three sets to win the French Open. And when he's done, he walks over to the crowd and hands the fucking kid the racket that he won this major with. And did you see it, Liam?
I did. Yeah, I saw it. I saw it.
Yeah, one of the coolest things ever. And anyway, I love that about sports. I love all the stories you told. Liam, great job, man. Like I said, maybe we got a... Rusty's gone. Maybe we got a... I might have another job for you, Liam. Between you and I'll call you later. Okay. Take it easy, brother. Let me... Go Habs, go, baby!
Go Habs, go Jimmy. Thanks for having me, and pass that along to Russ as well. I really enjoyed being on with him. That was a real treat.
Good deal, Liam. Take care, brother.
All right, pal.
There it is, folks. It's in the books. Well, sort of in the books. Rusty broke down. Liam McGuire, the one and only. All that you heard was not made up. And if you want a book, Liam, get a hold of me. Bring them to your dinners or your shows or whatever. You can reach out to suspendables.com. Stevie, we got an email there somewhere, don't we? Don't we still? Get the big voice to read it. We'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Suspendables is a weekly podcast series featuring former NHLer Russ Courtnell and host Jim Jerome. Join us for new episodes available each Wednesday morning. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to subscribe and review or share the show with your friends and followers. Check out our website today, thesuspendables.com.